I'm Christopher Lydon, standing at an intersection of astronomy and biology. It's where science is looking again for life forms on hundreds of newly discovered planets that are a lot like Earth. Dimitar Sasolov is our guide out here at a crossroads we didn't know existed, but he will make the chances of extraterrestrial life plausible, at least. It's a chase that draws on many kinds of imagination. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. In this case, cosmic attitude. Dimitar Sasolov, there's an urgency about you and about this book, The Life of Super Earths, that I hope you'll explain. There's a new search here for extraterrestrials that is not just listening for beeps or waiting for UFOs and men from Mars. What is it that's new? What is it that's happened? Just where are we these days?
Thank you, Chris. I know that the reason I wrote this book was because I felt this urgency. I felt that I need to share it with more people. I needed to share it with myself, writing the book. And where it comes from is two steps. The first one was those planets that we've always anticipated, we always dreamed of, orbiting other stars, are finally here. We know how to find them. We know how to study them. We know some of them are the size of Earth. Some of them probably have similar conditions. We'll know that in the next couple of years for sure.
You spotted something like 600, I gather.
They're growing by the week. It's now 700. the number is always moving up. We have more than 2,000 candidates. We know how to do this. What we don't know how to do, where the crossroads are, is the biology. We know where to look. These are the planets that we are discovering. We don't necessarily know what we should be looking for. Life, as we know it, is one example. We don't have a definition. We don't understand its basic nature. How in the cosmos are we supposed to find other life on other planets? We think we know the answer to that, but one thing is for sure, we haven't done our homework. We need to do more work. We need to understand better who we are. And then it's also telling everybody that there is a powerful opportunity there, an opportunity which is not just the philosophical, the human yearning for finding life on other planets, but understanding what life is means being able to do things down here on planet Earth much better. And I think everybody will benefit from it.
You speak of life as we know it. How different could it be on a planet 5,000 light years away, say?
We don't know. That's the first and only thing I could say for sure. But we have some ideas. Stephen Jay Gould liked to say that if you rewind the reel and play the movie again, the movie of life, the history of life, it's not going to be the same movie. And I believe he's right. But it's going to be the same chemistry. It's not going to be the same actors. It's not going to be the same screenplay. But it is going to be a movie which is based on what we hold dear and near to us. For life, that means there are functions which make a difference between what we call non-life and life. The ability to self-sustain, the ability to adapt, the ability to create a system which is essentially eternal. Once life starts, it is a system with potential for eternity. There is no other thing but the basic building blocks of the universe that are potentially eternal. And here you have a very complex system which has the same potential. That is something which we call basic functions of life, and they could have trillions of outside expressions, just like life on Earth. Behind every tree, behind every body, behind every little bacteria, there is absolutely the same biochemistry, the same structure of the DNA, the same structure of the RNA, the same proteins.
Do we expect life to be fundamentally the same building blocks of amino acids and DNA or RNA? I mean, is there a possibility that the deck is entirely shuffled?
That's exactly the big question. And in fact, that is what this book is about, half of it at least, the one on biology. It's not the question, do we understand and how do we understand the origin of life? That's a historical question. It's a tough question. It's the big question. But there is a smaller question, which may turn out to answer the big one, which is the basic chemistry of life given by the universal laws of chemistry? Just like gravity is the same in this galaxy, on this planet, as it is on any galaxy in the universe. It's a universal law of gravity. That's why it's called that way. Is it a universal chemical law that biochemistry will be based on the same molecules? Or are alternative biochemistries possible and, in fact, contingent on the environments that develop on those other planets? We can do this in the lab, and that's exactly why I'm so excited about this new development, because it will tell us something fundamental about life and will allow us to develop tools that we don't have now. And
the news that you're speaking about in astronomy is the confirmation, the discovery of these planets, vaguely Earth-like, out there around faraway stars. But I'm also interested in what's the news of biology that's given you a different take on early life, or maybe even advanced life out there.
The way it is shifting from the question, which is essentially astronomical, are there places for life out there, to the question in biology, which is, what does it take for life to emerge and to sustain itself in those places that astronomers are already discovering? It is a really historic shift. The previous question has been with us for at least 500, if not more than 500 years. Now the question in biology is becoming urgent, because we, the astronomers, have the capability in the next 20 years to present to you a gallery of planets which potentially could be living. But we don't know how to look for life which is anything but a carbon copy of ours. And so where we need to put our effort now is in the lab. We need to answer that question. What do we do about searching for maybe microbes out there? That's the best chance we have currently, because microbes are the ones which transform a planet. It's not the animals or the plants, as far as we understand it from here. And we can do this in the lab.
What makes it a new search? But then how do you recognize a microbe from infinite distances? How do you get to know it?
The microbe from infinite distances. I love that. This is exactly the point. The mighty microbe. Our planet is a planet of the microbes. Was and still is. It's not the planet of the plants and animals. Actually, almost 80% of the biomass of the biosphere is in microbes. It's not in plants and animals. There are microbes everywhere on our planet, in the atmosphere, in the oceans, on the surface, but particularly under the surface, in the crust, miles below the surface, miles below the bottom of the ocean. They're microbes. We haven't actually reached the deepest reaches of the biosphere yet. Everywhere we drill, we find new forms of microbes, which are very deep inside the crust. So what is important to realize is that from the entire history of life on Earth and the geological history of planet Earth, it's definitely clear that the microbial biosphere, the microbes as populations, as groups of populations, have been able early on and still capable to transform the surface and to transform the atmosphere to the point where you can see it thousands of light years away. The way this happens is through their exchange of nutrients and gases with the surface and the atmosphere. The atmospheric biosphere has literally transformed the atmosphere of the Earth early on to the point where it resembles nothing like a normal planet. And in the 20th century, we learned how to measure those kind of signatures remotely. We call it remote sensing. We use it nowadays to study the Earth back from space. We use it to measure tiny amounts of gas on Mars, on the other planets in the solar system, without leaving the surface of the Earth. We can do that with radio and optical telescopes from here. It's called remote sensing. It's a way of detecting small, even trace amounts of a gas using the changes in the color of an object which may be at the edge of our universe. We've done so for very distant stars, billions of light years away. So that's not the difficult part. The difficult part is, what exactly are we looking for? What are these biosignature gases that we would expect alien life to produce? if it was exactly like what our biosphere produces, well, sure, we know how to find that. But again, going back to Stephen Jay Gould and rewinding the reel, if you have the option of a different chemistry, you're definitely in a completely different universe when it comes to life and its diversity. Even if you don't have a different basic chemistry, but the chemistry is the same, you still could have life and the biosphere which would evolve in a different way.
Is it some sort of Earth chauvinism or the patriotism of this planet that expects life forms to resemble ours infinite distances away?
It is, but I'm afraid it's more than that. It's also lack of imagination. It has happened to us before. In fact, it happened just 15 years ago. The first discovery of exoplanets. We had the solar system, the single example of a planetary system. We had built over the past 300 years very elaborate theoretical constructs of how those planets formed, and we had generalized them, meaning we had assumed that this is how planets around other stars will form and planetary systems would resemble and follow those rules based on a single example. What we found, even with the first exoplanet discovered, exoplanet is a short for planet orbiting another star, okay, not in our solar system, and basically other solar systems, if you will. The first one which was discovered was already breaking a paradigm in a very surprising and big way. The second, third, fourth one broke a couple of other paradigms. We were surprised, I would say not unpleasantly, because scientists welcome nice surprises and interesting avenues for research. But it gave us a pause. It gave me a pause in particular, that having a single example can always essentially let you live and work in a bubble. And our imagination sometimes is not rich enough to imagine. Now think about life on other planets. It's even a more scary situation when you think about it as a scientist. Not only do we have a single example here on our planet, just like our solar system, but by all accounts, it's a much more complex system with much more opportunity for richness and diversity. So after our fresh example of getting it wrong with the solar system and planetary systems, we should be careful not to get it wrong again with other life. I'm not so much concerned that we're going to discover something which we didn't imagine. I'd love that. What I'm more concerned about is it's going to be so different from what we've had imagined and thought it was that we are not going to recognize it. We'll miss it. It will be under our nose. We'll be looking at it and we'll miss it altogether.
On this matter of Earth chauvinism, I mean, we are famously attached to the notion that human beings are the center of this Earth, which is the center of everything. On the other hand, Douglas Adams in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has that famous line about, with this utterly insignificant blue-green planet with ape-descended life forms so primitive that they think digital watches are a big deal. Between Douglas Adams and the traditional sort of Earth and human centrism, what's your own sense of how important, how unique, how exceptional we are?
I think we are unique and exceptional for our own sake here. Yet, it is because we explore this universe with our own roots, and our roots are our planet. In fact, the big point of my book is that our planet is not a cradle of life or a home for life. The planet and life on it are the same thing. We are the living planet. We are part of that living planet. So if there are millions of those living planets in our galaxy and there are trillion of those galaxies out there, we are not alone. We are majority. We are the 4%, but a very important part of this 4% of ordinary matter. So yes, we are Earth-centric because our roots are here, but that's a good thing. That's the same as bringing our own perspective to brotherhood of perspectives out there, our own culture, if you will, where culture now is the biochemistry which makes us, where our self is not just Homo sapiens, but the entire microbiome of trillion of microbes that live inside us, on top of us, and we that are part of ourselves, that are personally us. We are not who we think we are. And in a certain sense, that should bring us down to earth, literally, and also take this earth as one of those unique yet common trees of life, which are, if not the first in this galaxy, certainly of the first generation in this young universe. So I see it both ways. I see it both as the Copernican principle of mediocrity, is that we are not the center of this universe, and also as the proud Earthling, which is moving out there, exploring this universe, and bringing with this exploration their own unique earthly roots.
What is the correspondence between planets and the biology of teensy systems in molecules and atoms?
I love that question. I think there is a tantalizing resemblance between the places in this universe which have the temperature range, the chemical makeup to let life as we know it emerge and sustain itself, planets like the Earth, and their global cycles. We call them global geochemical cycles because they essentially make the whole planet operate in a way not dissimilar from what we would call a metabolic cycle for a single cell microbe. The cycle that I'm referring here to on the Earth is called the carbon cycle, which is a purely planetary cycle without life being involved in it, although life has co-opted it, but purely as a planetary cycle that's bringing that richness of chemistry and active gases through volcanoes and other places on the surface of the Earth into the atmosphere. Mostly carbon dioxide is the one which then rains down, chemically interacts with the surface and the oceans. The chemical products which are inert accumulate at the bottom of the oceans. With the subduction of plates, tectonic plates, this inert material, spent material if you want, is recycled back into the interior of the Earth where it's molten, recycled, put back into the atmosphere through the volcanoes, and the whole cycle keeps going on and on, renewing all the time the surface and the atmosphere of the planet, and interestingly, very interestingly, acting as a thermostat to the global climate of the planet, keeping the temperature within a certain range. It's a very interesting mechanism, which seems to be true not only for this cycle, but for other cycles which happen not to be active in our solar system, but we expect them to be out there for those super-Earth planets that we are discovering now.
Dmitry Sersov, it's very much in my mind that you and I met quite by accident in the Boston Public Library at the end of last year. I'm trying to figure out just what it was that clicked and how we got talking that night about how public conversation works in Bulgaria, where you grew up, and in Boston and Cambridge and the United States generally, where so much 21st century science is being hatched. Who talks to whom? Who's not talking to whom? Who's completely ignorant of things they might contribute to? And vice versa. How does it work? Of course, I'm interested in how we make the American conversation better, but what's your experience been from your first teenage yen for science and where one learns and who one talks to?
I love that event at the Boston Public Library that you led there. And the reason I loved it is because we had scientists talking about books which were in the humanities, and we had people from the humanities talking about science books. And that is what I loved, simply being there, being part of that conversation. And that is what I thought we need, both on the science side, and I don't know so much about the humanities, but certainly in our society, that interaction, not only to know about each other, not only to essentially know what's happening in the lab that could change your life, but in fact, bringing all of this forward together. Because I strongly believe that whether you're a scientist or an artist or a creative person, when you're doing what you do best at the edge of knowledge and creativity, that process of creativity is exactly the same. You don't have the precise numbers. you don't have the precise knowledge, you don't have the precise picture, you have the intuition which helps you see through. And it is only afterwards that the scientists fall back on their precise equations and measurements, while the artists would do something to put together in a clear way what came to them during that moment of creation. But the moment of creation, I believe, is the same. And there is a parallel in this process of creativity. And this is something which is very human. It requires people to be next to each other, to talk to each other, and to talk to each other in a way in which they don't necessarily know why they do it. Serendipity is very important there. There is no alternative to it. There is no way to do it remotely. There is no way to do it even on the internet. I think the human connection there is very important. I know you can do it on the internet as a proxy for seeing each other maybe once a month. But knowing each other personally, being able to see each other from time to time, I think is very important. And if we think about the Boston area, let's start it locally, because it is local.
Would you just stop there before you get to Boston? I want to know, what was your experience of this process of exchange, consultation, social connection in Bulgaria?
Well, we have this word which comes from Eastern Europe, Russia and Central Eastern Europe, which is intelligentsia. It's a group of people who essentially the creative elite, if you want, although elite was not necessarily the proper word for most of its members, because you wouldn't think of them as having anything else in common except that they're creative people. They wanted to be together, they're curious by nature, and they just wanted to find out more, whether it's about new discovery in science, a new concept, a new poem, a new novel. In Bulgaria, we had that as a small group of people who knew each other. Their parents knew each other, then their kids ended up knowing each other. They met in college. But you know, Bulgaria is a small country. So there was essentially one big university, one big city, Sofia. So I could see how this could work out and go on for years, decades, maybe a century. And I guess the same was true in Hungary and Czech Republic, even in a big country like Russia. So when I came to Canada in the end of the 80s, beginning of 90s, I was somewhat dismayed that there were such brilliant people in the University of Toronto and Toronto in general who actually didn't know each other. They might have known about each other, but because they were poets and scientists, they just didn't intersect anywhere in there. And I thought this was a huge missed opportunity for the people themselves, for the society in general. But I know as a scientist that it's very important for me to be able to bounce ideas beyond my technical science circle. Scientists work together because they need to bounce ideas and because they need to think through ideas with their peer. But whenever those ideas go a little bit beyond the circle of technicalities into the big picture, you immediately run into questions which are not simply philosophical, but questions which relate to language. How do you see this from a different angle? How do you approach the big picture? And one of the best ways for me to even understand what I was trying to do personally in my scientific work when it came to the big picture was to talk to somebody who was not a scientist, who was a thinking, creative person, who was giving me a completely different perspective on what I was trying to figure out in my own head. And this is where this concept of intelligentsia is such a valuable thing for society. I believe it goes beyond just being a fun thing to do for a group of friends to get together.
If you could spend an evening or live next door to any artist, philosopher, poet, musician, writer in the world, I mean, who might you love to see life with?
Chris, I can actually give you many examples from my previous experience. Well, very particular ones.
Take them all.
I mean, let's start with music. I happen to like music like everybody else. I like jazz, but I never really got to know how music is made until I was in Toronto and met people, among others, from the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. And then I discovered that there was some of those approaches to performing the music, especially in brass instruments, which were very similar to what I did in my own research, where I was studying the acoustics of stars. I was not the first one to discover that the acoustics of stars had something to do with acoustics in musical instruments. Mm. But that opened a whole new universe for me. And frankly, it gave me an opportunity to see something more into the equations that I was solving and improve upon them. I think there was a direct connection there between my somewhat idle-looking conversations with people who are extremely good brass players and my work on the distance scale of the universe, which depends on understanding the acoustics of stars. I have a cousin who is a literary critic, and he once visited me from Paris in Toronto. We were sitting in a cafe and just having coffee and talking, just meeting each other. And he said, you know what? I'm actually working while I'm sitting here in the cafe because I'm looking at the people around and I'm getting material for my next book while you are wasting your time because you work on the physics of nuclear fission in stars. And I said, well, you know what? I'm not wasting my time. Because while you're looking at the people sitting around us on the tables and listening to their conversations, and then we're talking to each other, I'm also thinking about what is it that I'm doing in the bigger picture? Why are these stars so interesting to us? What is it that we are trying to learn by studying them? And what resulted from that was this work on the scale of the universe using those stars, which in the meantime was aided by talking to some musicians at the Toronto Symphony. So there is for you that combination of completely unplanned, serendipitous opportunities, cross paths, conversations, visuals that make up the richness of the creative process.
Yeah,
it's almost impossible to describe in words.
It's fascinating. It reminds me a little bit. I mean, there are echoes of Steve Jobs' crush on Yo-Yo Ma and all that sort of thing. But actually, you know, we've been hearing about this problem for a long time. When I was a schoolboy, C.P. Snow wrote that book about the two cultures, the people who understand the second law of thermodynamics don't read Trollope novels and vice versa, and these are getting to be two different worlds. To me, it's even more interesting today because in this neighborhood, I mean, not far from Vassar and Main Street in Cambridge, in the heart of MIT, and the central work on nanotechnology, on artificial intelligence, on all the cognitive sciences, computers, the wiring and firing of brain neurons, all of these things are not just big industry. They're changing the shape of the work people do, but they're in some sense changing our whole understanding of what the human being is and what it's for and how it got there and where it's going. And it's astonishing to me in a city that is also a center of music, maybe second only to New York in this country, but also of poetry, also of sports, also of all kind of other writing and intellectual enterprise, there's an amazing non-connection of all these very, very high-aspiring powers. So define the problem, and then let's figure out how to do something about it.
I think you said it beautifully. So what do we do about it? I mean, I think Boston is just the right size to make this happen. It's not too big. And it's not too small. It has the critical mass for sure. It's not as big as New York or some other bigger places. So we could do it. I think the problem is that a lot of those scientists and artists are too busy doing their thing and being the best in the world in what they do.
I wonder, do the big-time scientists, do you have time to listen to 4 hours of symphonic music twice a week or even once a month?
Once a month for sure, but I wish I could do it more often. And you know what? I wish I actually knew some of those people personally. I think ultimately it is in the personal touch, the opportunity to get beyond what the peak of their performance is, behind the scenes, if you will. The same way as they could go and read my book, and I hope they like it, I'm sure they will learn a lot more if they had an opportunity to talk 20 minutes with me. the same way I will learn a lot more, and I'll be a lot more motivated and excited if I had the 20 minutes to talk to them. This is what I experienced whenever I had this opportunity. And I feel that the Boston area is perfect for that. And I should say, I see these opportunities here and I take advantage of them. I just think that there are many more and we could do something about it. I think one way in which this could be done is that there is a virtual way to bring people together, but then use that as an enabling tool to bring them together in real and not only virtually.
Where would you want to bring them together?
Some comfortable place where we could sit and talk. Coffee always helps, you know, the human interaction has a tipping point of 6, 10. You can't really have a meaningful opportunity to talk to more than 10 people at the same time. From time to time, there are great events which turn into event like this. Could be something like a mini TED, a TEDx, except explicitly meant to do that connection, bring those kind of people together. I think what is more important is to be there available all the time. Because if you only do it once a year, there will always be people who are not going to be able to make it that once time. On the other hand, if you have a place where you can always walk in and there is always somebody there, then that could become part of your day, part of your week, part of your month if you don't have that much time. I think the old model is still of the 20th century, of the cafe, of a place where you just pass by after work or for lunch, and whoever is there, you talk to them. But you know somebody will be there. Some of the people you really want to talk to and meet. That hasn't changed with our internet age. Maybe except that it's easier to do it now. There is an online site like that by John Brockman in New York, edge.org. It's a great site, but the value of it is that it allows for some people sometimes to meet each other in person. And because it's so vast and because New York is so big, this much more seldom, meaning the meeting in person, than it should be. And that's why I think the Boston area could be much more successful in doing the real thing, not just the virtual.
I'm wondering why I immediately think of Symphony Hall and music, even 19th century music, as somehow the place that moves every kind of person. And I can think of lots of examples. Vicky Weisskopf, a physicist at MIT for many, many years in the Manhattan Project, but he played piano, violin, duets all his life. I remember him talking. We used to talk about Brahms's Opus 118, number 2, a great piano piece, and he thought that was, and I think I agreed with him, it was sort of the pinnacle of created beauty. But, you know, I think of Stephen Jay Gould, too, listening to Brahms' piano music and being moved, being humbled. And also he sang, Stephen Jay Gould sang Haydn's Creation. For an anti-creationist, that was a remarkable sort of leap. But he felt Haydn was smack on the science of his time, and he also thought it was simply magnificent music. And in a Boston Cecilia, he sang it numerous times. He sang it for us. So is it lazy me that can't get out of the realm of music as the place where every kind of performer, every kind of sort of high-intensity human being can be both exalted and humbled in one fabulous process?
Music is an excellent example. It's an excellent way to connect people, I think, not only because of the examples from my own life that I gave you, but also because there is so much into music, both from science and from physiology and life and biology and chemistry, that all comes together, touches us all in the same way. It's abstract enough to allow us to have our own world in the same piece. It can go all the way from ancient music to the most modern, sometimes rethought in very interesting ways, part of our time, of what our new notions of technology are. One of the most fascinating conversations I was lucky enough to have with Benoit Mandelbrot were about music and why is it that we perceive music the way we do. And of course, he had a very technical explanation based on fractal geometry and fractal mathematics. But the beauty of it was that past the technical details, there was a real opportunity to look beyond the horizon at the big picture of what is it that makes us human and what is it in the world around us that is somehow purified, encapsulated in what we call music and why we perceive it that way and why it moves us that way. So music, definitely. I think any kind of creative arts is a way of getting the conversation on the right track. You see, I know a lot of musicians and artists who do not want to talk about what they do. They say, just look at it or listen to it.
Right.
And then there are those of us who have to talk, have to use language to explain those concepts, those ideas. And then there are the people who create with language. So in order to bring all those four magisteria together, you need something which is glued by the aura of music, is surrounded by the visual arts, if you want.
Come back to the quest for life forms on these newly discovered Earth-like planets. What's the most exotic, furthest from the science of it, contributor that you've been able to enlist in just thinking about what you're doing?
I would say that our team at this point is mostly scientists who are very intent on doing something which is a breakthrough. So from those of the team who are furthest away from science, well, I don't want to think of them as not being scientists. Maybe I have a very broad definition of a scientist. I would consider anybody who is creative and contributing to the thinking process, even if they don't have a white lab coat and mix minerals or look through a telescope as a scientist, as long as they're part of it. I'll have to... No, I don't think anybody in our team is exotic in that sense. I think what is exotic is what we are trying to do. We are literally trying to rediscover biochemistry in the lab, the way it was built over billions of years on this planet. So how much more exotic do you get?
Bob Doerr was speaking about a recent Nobel winner who was part of your gang, but not exactly on the specific science. Is that somebody you can speak about?
Well, Jack Szostak is my main co-conspirator. Andy Knoll and Jack Szostak and I essentially got together initially to start this team. Several others are from that initial gang and still the main core of the team, Stein Jakobsen, George Whiteside, Scott Martin. But Jack Szostak in particular is the most exotic connection to this whole endeavor, because he's diametrically on the other side of the scientific disciplines to where I stand. I am an astronomer, a physicist by background. So the physics of the biggest world structures is what I knew. And Jack Szostak is a molecular biologist, a biologist who studies the basics of life, the structure of DNA. That's what he got the Nobel Prize for. The structure of the membranes that encapsulate every cell. And the mere fact that it's been now 5 years and we still talk to each other, engage in work where we think it's worth our time to put a lot of our effort, and the curiosity hasn't gone away, the excitement has only gone up. To me, that's almost a miracle that I met somebody like him. And I think emphasizes the issue which we have here, is that there is a big gap between what we call the big cold world of inanimate matter of planets, stars, and galaxies out there, and anything, everything that we know about what we call life.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to build a bridge across that gap, and we even have no sense how large this gap is, except we are happily building those two pieces of the metal bridge and hope that we'll meet in the middle.
Was it Jack Szostak who persuaded you that biology is the future of astronomy? That Jack Szostak is the future of Dimitar Sasolov?
I think it was a synergy, one of those conversations that we talked about where you don't know who said what first and why, and it was not necessarily intended or scripted, or you even didn't realize it at the time. But I certainly believe that there are two meanings to that. One is the superficial one, which is the obvious one. We astronomers are seeing so far away and in such detail now that we have to learn biology in order to understand what we're looking for. But there is a much deeper meaning to saying that biology is the future of astronomy. If astronomy is the big universe as we know it, and we have known it for the last 13 billion years, the big universe is made up of ordinary matter, dark matter, and dark energy. These are three major components. Ordinary matter that we are all made of is just 4% of the total. But this 4% of the total, the 4% that have the ability to do chemistry. Dark matter and dark energy just sit there, practically do nothing compared to what ordinary matter can do. And what ordinary matter can do, essentially, is what we call life. That's the most complex chemistry that these atoms of the 4% are engaging in and have engaged in. We see it on this planet. We haven't seen it on other planets yet. But if our hunch is right, it is a phenomenon which has engaged in this young universe, which is still very young at 13 billion and counting, and which is about to go into the deep future, the deep time, as Martin Rees calls it, for many, many more times into the future without much change. The 4%, the dark matter, the dark energy are going to continue doing the same thing. There will be more stars, there will be more planets. But the part which is really going to change, and I have a hunch that it is going to change the universe, is those 4% that are able to do the complex chemistry which we call life, and that are able, as a result of that, to transcend the limitations of a single star and of a single planetary system. So the future of that universe may well be a biological future.
The future of that universe may well be a biological future. Meaning just what?
Meaning that if you look at the universe today and in the past 13 billion years, its state is determined by the forces of gravity and mostly by the action of dark matter, which we still don't understand quite well, but we see its large-scale distribution. It's like a large web today. It was less so in the beginning, but it slowly forms this web. And all the galaxies, the clusters of galaxies, the individual galaxies, and the stars in the galaxies are following those subtle peaks and valleys of the large-scale distribution of dark matter. This is the universe we live in. This is the observable universe. We see it. It's in front of our eyes. But that is not going to change in any conceivable manner in the next trillion of years in the future. It's just going to continue the same way. It's going to expand. It's going to slowly clump a little bit more here and there. But it's going to be what you see today. Where the big changes are happening are on those trillions of planets which are in those galaxies where chemistry is taking hold. It becomes complex enough and it's moving to slowly take hold of one galaxy at a time. And given trillions of years into the future, who knows where it's going to get.
So the whole thing has a chance of coming alive, I take it.
In a certain way, that's the hunch you get from watching what's happening now. And as Arthur C. Clarke once said, those living creatures in that deep time of the future will envy us because we were the ones who knew the universe when it was young.
There's a little bit of ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny or at an astronomical scale. Do I get it? I have a glimmer, maybe.
It's all glimmers. As Cavafis used to say, you know, you can only sense where the future may go.
But Richard Strauss could put it to music, maybe. Dimitar Seslov, it's such a pleasure to pretend I'm following you here, but maybe I am. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Such a pleasure.